Good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome to Let There Be Sound. I'm David Giovannone, and I'm joined by Patrick Feaster, Renee Rondeau, and a cadre of colleagues who are striving to reinstill in all of us the wonder of sound recording. In 2008, we take sound recording and playback for granted. It's old technology, and for most of us, it's an avocation or a job that day in, day out, year after year, you know, let's face it, it can lose its charm. But in 1878, Edison's phonograph was indeed charmed. It was magic. And I use that term as Arthur C. Clarke did when he said, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic." This simple machine that magically repeated anything it heard struck the earth like a meteor, leaving a rich sediment of newspaper and magazine accounts several months deep. 130 years later, our excavation of these accounts indicates that Edison's phonograph had a mind-bending impact on humanity. The phonograph bent minds because the phonograph could bend time. It could stretch it, it could shorten it, it could stop it, it could even reverse it. Sounds pitched higher, pitched lower, talking backwards, disembodied from their creator. This magic had never been done. When you recorded a sound, you froze it in time. When you messed with its playback, you didn't just manipulate sound, you manipulated time itself. Now, this all may seem quite quaint to our magic-soaked minds. We read the old press accounts, and man, do our ancestors seem easily impressed, unsophisticated, naive. But think about it. How would we react if this morning we woke up and learned that time travel became possible? I mean, literally something we could do with a turn of a crank. Zip into the past, jump into the future. Now that would blow our minds, and certainly we're not easily impressed, unsophisticated, or naive. So magic isn't about just technology. It's about what we know and what we're used to when we meet that technology for the first time. If we're to understand what Edison's phonograph meant to people in 1878, we need to hear it as they did. We have to forget what we know and what we're used to and travel back to an age when, you know, like the idea of time travel today, talking machines and phonographs were the daydreams of poets and the possessed.
Yo, thanks. On December 15th, 1877, Thomas Edison signed the paperwork for this patent on what he called a phonograph or speaking machine. I imagine many of you think of phonograph and speaking machine as two interchangeable names for the same thing, which would suggest that Edison was being a bit redundant by identifying his invention as a phonograph or talking machine. But if you'd been a well-read American living in 1877, you would have understood these words differently. You would have had a good idea as to what a speaking machine or talking machine was. Chances are you would even have experienced one in action before. If you were into acoustics, you might have known what a phonograph was as well. And if you did, you would have known that talking machines and phonographs were two entirely different things, that combining them into a single package was a 19th century equivalent to offering a Vegematic that slices and dices. Except that in this case, past efforts at slicing and dicing had themselves not lived up to their full potential. Phonographs and talking machines alike had long straddled the line between reality and science fiction, hinting at possibilities on which they had yet fully to deliver. So let's survey what you might reasonably have known before 1877 about phonographs and talking machines. those two very different things: what they were, how they worked, what people had been doing with them, and what kind of future your wildest imagination might have conjured up for them. And then afterwards, we'll consider how Thomas Edison's breakthrough suddenly changed everything. Before 1877, this would have been your idea of a talking machine, the Faber talking machine, widely exhibited in Europe and America and designed to produce intelligible speech sounds by replicating the physical workings of the human vocal apparatus. Here's its story in a nutshell. Joseph Faber, its creator, was a former land surveyor for the Habsburg Emperor who had begun work on his talking machine to keep busy after a medical condition forced him into early retirement. He smashed his original machine to bits in Philadelphia in 1844, upset at its reception there, but a replacement he unveiled in 1845 attracted the attention of showman P.T. Barnum, who put it on display in London the next year. When Faber died in 1866, he left the machine to his niece, Maria Trunka. In 1868, she and her boyfriend, later husband, Samuel Hussert, launched their own career as itinerant talking machine exhibitors, adopting the professional names Joseph and Maria Faber. By 1885, they'd fallen on hard times and divorced after Samuel tried to use the machine as payment for a hotel bill. Alone and friendless in New York City, Maria attempted suicide in July 1887 by swallowing rat poison. Newspaper reports suggest that she still had the talking machine in her possession at the time. But in 1886, the year after the divorce, Samuel had turned up with a talking machine in Chicago, leaving the ultimate fate of the machine something of a mystery. There had been talking machines before Faber's. Indeed, Faber himself is supposed to have got his idea from reading the work of Wolfgang von Kempelen, who had exhibited a device along similar lines during the 1780s, shown here. The Kempelen-Farkas Speech Research Laboratory at the Hungarian Academy of Sciences built a replica of Kempelen's machine a few years ago and produced these test files of its speech. You'll first hear someone speak the words and then the machine's attempt at them.
Es war I go je t'aime.
Yeah. Kempelen had also proposed a keyboard-operated machine in a book he published in 1791, rather similar to the one Faber eventually built. So there were precursors, but Faber's appears to have been the most successful of these efforts, and it was certainly the best known in 1877. How did it work? Well, a foot pedal forced air from a bellows through a complicated artificial vocal apparatus. A row of black levers controlled the vocal apparatus by adjusting the position of the tongue and lips, lowering different combinations of impediments to block the passage of air through the larynx and so on. The 14 levers started with the vowels on the left and then worked their way through the consonants, which could be modified using the nasal and aspirate keys found underneath on the right. A screw determined the pitch of the machine's ordinary speaking voice, which could only be adjusted between phrases, or alternatively, the operator could make the vocal apparatus sing by hooking it up to a built-in musical organ, which had its keyboard at a right angle to the speech levers. During performances, the instrument's inner workings could be concealed by a curtain around the sides and in front, by a face mask and torso with arms crossed, furnishing an anthropomorphic figure, sometimes a girl, sometimes a turbaned Turk, who could be imagined as doing the talking. Thus, Faber sometimes had the machine greet people entering the room and hold conversations with them. When someone asked the machine its name, he had it respond with euphonia. A typical exhibition would have begun with the machine apologizing for its pronunciation, running through the alphabet, trying out a few common phrases in different languages, and attempting challenge words suggested by the audience. To vary the program, it would speak in a high voice, a medium voice, a low voice. It would mimic laughter and crying. In the early days, Faber would next play a wordless melody on the musical organ and then hook it up to the speech apparatus for his grand finale, a song complete with words such as Hail Columbia or God Save the Queen. However, the musical half of the machine had fallen into disrepair by the early 1870s. Audiences agreed that Faber's machine was an impressive feat of ingenuity. They were less sure what good talking machines could do. One possibility was that they would eventually advance scientific knowledge of speech acoustics, as Alexander Ellis observed in 1845, claiming that this was their real importance, raising them far above the grade of simple curiosities and placing them in the rank of necessaries for human improvement. Unfortunately, nobody got a close enough look at the innards of the Faber machine to gain any such insight. Another writer predicted in 1844 that, before a great while, we may witness deaf and dumb people sitting at speaking pianos and delivering public lectures. That might have been more likely. Joseph Henry mentioned that Faber himself spoke English better through his machine than through his mouth. But critics often quipped that Faber's invention was unnecessary because there were already plenty of talking machines at work. For instance, in the British Parliament. Here's Lord George Bentinck supposedly playing Benjamin Disraeli as his talking machine. And then here's a joke from 1846. A man in the western part of this state called his neighbor into his house not long since to see a famous talking machine he had there. He said if the proper key were touched, it would commence talking in the greatest volubilities. The neighbors came, and the man introduced to them the famous machine, which proved to be his wife. A lot of different variations on that one. Of course, Faber's machine only talked when someone was sitting there playing it. But it could theoretically have been worked in other ways, as contemporaries noted. For example, it could be placed at one end of a telegraph line and made to talk automatically, allowing a person at the other end to deliver the same sermon to a dozen churches at once. Other similar devices ran semi-automatically, talking dolls like this one being a very simple example. You know the deal. Ma, ma. Some talking machines were even programmed to speak just like a barrel organ or music box. Here you see the Abbe McCall. Here you see the Abbe McCall's talking heads displayed in Paris in the 1780s. These automatically recited several sentences in praise of the soon-to-be-beheaded Louis XVI, leading to speculation that such machines could preserve a model of correct French pronunciation for posterity. Faber doesn't seem to have thought much of the idea of programming his talking machine, but his contemporaries did playfully suggest using it to automate announcements in railway stations, singing in church choirs, and preaching in churches, so that the parson could program his sermon in advance and sleep in on Sunday morning. Insofar as the main job of politicians is to talk, critics argued that machines might be an improvement on them too, since the talking machine wouldn't speak with a funny accent, pursue personal ambitions, or accept bribes. As one wrote, "There will be a great demand for it in this country to serve as a 4th of July orator, owing to its ability to keep sober until after the speech is made." The most elaborate speculation appears in a short story of 1873 by Fred B. Perkins called The Man You Factory, describing the fictional Budlong and Faber Company, which sent out talking machine androids for use in churches as mechanical ministers and on lecture circuits as substitutes for famous speakers. The proprietor explains, and I quote, "You see, the first-class speakers receive 10 times as many invitations as they can accept. Now we furnish a facsimile who exactly duplicates the eminent gentleman, and we have half the money. Between you and me, we have had as many as 5 of one or two gentlemen speaking in different parts of the United States at the same time." The obstacle impeding such uses was that in reality, the machine's pronunciation was slow, imperfect, hard to understand, and very strange. Contemporaries described it as dreary, monotonous, drawling, melancholy, sepulchral, tormented, reminiscent of the voice of a man whose lungs are filled with pus and mucus, and whose earthly career is almost run. Or again, the loud, clear voice pronounced all its words in exactly the same tone without any instinctive modulation. The effect was horrible. One instantly thought of a terrible dead man suddenly galvanized into a mockery of life. When newspapers quoted the Faber talking machine, they often put dashes between its words, as you see here, trying to evoke its peculiar sound, probably the closest thing the 19th century had to illogical does not compute. There was also the occasional hoax in which someone exhibited a fake talking machine with a concealed human speaker. But when they did, as in this case from 1855, it seems they tried to imitate the inhuman monotone. See the dashes? After all, if a machine sounded too much like a real person, then you could be pretty sure there was really a ventriloquist lurking somewhere nearby. Thus far, I've been talking about talking machines, inanimate things with robot voices that dared mimic something properly unique to humanity, conjuring up images of Frankenstein's monster, the living dead, and mechanical abominations replacing human beings. But now I'd like to consider the phonograph half of the equation, which instead centered on the dream of recording exactly those things talking machines couldn't manage. That hard-to-define something that made human speech distinctively human and that lent passion and emotion to performances of oratory and music. Now, the idea of automatically recording extemporaneous performances of keyboard music dates back in European tradition to roughly the mid-18th century. The specific arrangement you see here was proposed by an English clergyman named Creed sometime before 1747. This approach would work pretty well for capturing keyboard improvisations with all their impassioned genius. But what about extemporaneous singing or dramatic speech? There was shorthand, of course, but that had to be done manually and didn't capture all the wonderful subtleties of the voice. In 1775, Joshua Steele proposed a new system for inscribing the nuances of great oratorical performances, rhythm, tone, shifts in volume, and so forth, claiming, "If the method here essayed can be brought into familiar use, the types of modern elocution may be transmitted to posterity as accurately as we have received the musical compositions of Corelli." But all this detail had to be recorded by hand, and it generally went by way too quickly to scribble it down. Another ambitious writing system was Melville Bell's visible speech, so precise that it could accurately represent the distinction between a murmur, a drowsy murmur, and an uneasy murmur, along with gasps, growls, sobs, sneezes, and any dialect you might choose to throw at it. This, too, had to be written down by hand. But what if all this valuable detail could be captured automatically, as with that method for recording keyboard music? At the start of the 19th century, a method had emerged for making sound vibrations record themselves. At first, these were nothing more complicated than the sine waves of a tuning fork, but then Edouard Léon Scott de Martinville enters our story. Scott was a Parisian typesetter who had published a history of shorthand writing in 1849 and was very interested in quick and efficient means of getting speech down on paper. One day in 1852, while correcting the proofs of a treatise on physiology, Scott hit upon the idea of substituting an artificially constructed ear for the vibrating tuning fork, believing that it would write down not just a sine wave, but any sounds in the surrounding atmosphere that a human ear ordinarily picks up. He deposited a sealed packet at the French Academy of Sciences in January 1857, describing his idea, which he called phonautography. The word phonography was already taken by a system of phonetic stenography scribbled down by hand. "Is there a possibility," Scott wrote, "of reaching, in the case of sound, a result analogous to that attained at present for light by photographic processes, Can one hope that the day is near when the musical phrase escaped from the singer's lips will be written by itself, and as if without the musician's knowledge, on a docile paper, and leave an imperishable trace of those fugitive melodies which the memory no longer finds when it seeks them? Will one be able to have placed between two men brought together in a silent room an automatic stenographer that preserves the discussion in its minutest details while adapting to the speed of the conversation? Will one be able to preserve for the future generation some features of the diction of one of those eminent actors, those grand artists who die without leaving behind them the faintest trace of their genius? Scott believed the answer to all these questions was yes, and he attached the first pair of test recordings he claimed to have made 3 years earlier, one of speech, one of a guitar. Apparently, just by attaching a stylus to a membrane similar to the eardrum and dragging it across a blackened surface while someone shouted or played nearby. Here you see the first recording Scott ever made using this revolutionary principle. In March 1857, Scott applied for a patent on a phonautograph modeled closely after the middle ear, with two membranes corresponding to the tympanum and oval window, with an airtight space in between and a stylus attached to the bottom one. At first, the phonautograph recorded its squiggles on flat sheets of glass covered with lamp black, as you see here. But in 1859, Scott filed a certificate of addition to his patent, describing a new model he had worked out in collaboration with Rudolf Koenig, a respected maker of precision instruments. Now there was just one membrane, and the recording surface was a lamp black sheet wrapped around a cylinder. Scott still hoped he would be able to record great oratory with this machine, claiming that its trace was a kind of reptile, the coils of which follow all the modulations or inflections of discourse. He carefully identified particular types of squiggle with particular types of speech in this key: the deep voice, the high-pitched voice, a high-pitched voice descending to a deep one, a deep voice rising to the high-pitched one, an intense voice, an average voice, a weak voice, and so on. Supposing that people would learn to read and appreciate a new kind of text that might look something like this. As Louis Figuier wrote in an early editorial about the phonautograph, "Writing and print express speech, it is true, but speech dead and faded. You chance to hear some beautiful verses recited by Rachel." Here you see Rachel, a famous actress of the period. "Write them down and give them to a child to read, you'll no longer recognize them." The phonautograph, Figuier claimed, would preserve that special something that made a great performance great. And Figuier's comments were particularly poignant because at the time he was writing, Rachel, a longtime sufferer from consumption, was either on her deathbed or had just died. If only she'd made phonautograms, Figuier suggests, something of her genius could have remained alive. Scott signed away the rights to build phonautographs for sale to Koenig, who developed and promoted it strictly as an apparatus for dry scientific studies of sound. But Scott still dreamed of doing something more profound with his invention. In 1860, he parted ways with Koenig, returned to his two-membrane arrangement, and introduced a few more innovations, such as you see here, a lever for amplifying waveforms and a mechanism equivalent to the bones of the middle ear. He presented his final accomplishments in phonautography to the French Academy in 1861 and then abandoned his acoustic research to spend the next 15 years working as a librarian and bibliographer. The first person to suggest using a phonogram to reproduce sound waves, to the best of my knowledge, was Franz Josef Pisco in his 1865 book, Die Neueren Apparate der Akustik. But before you get excited, here's what he had in mind, and I quote, "Phonautograms and the reproduction of the vibrations. If one of the phonograms printed above is covered with a paper that has a very narrow notch or aperture in such manner that only a very small piece of the curve is to be seen through the aperture, and the phonogram or the covering paper is slowly pulled to the left or right, then the points of the wavy line appearing through the slit imitate the motion of that body that originally sounded, from which the inscription of sound actually stems. Only now the motion is slower and can therefore be grasped better with the eye. The friendly reader will hopefully make this easy and indeed pleasant experiment. Not quite what we understand as sound reproduction, is it? Meanwhile, people had been imagining a device for really playing sounds back for years. They had just never linked the idea to the phonautograph. In 1856, the year before Scott went public with his idea, the French photographer Félix Nadar had predicted an acoustic daguerreotype, faithfully reproducing at will all the sounds submitted to its lens. And he returned to the idea in 1864, supposing people would bring their phonographs, as he called them, home from a night at the opera to share and critique excerpts they'd recorded. But Nadar had no idea how this sound photography might work. And neither did a writer for the Scientific American, who in 1867 proposed a photophonography by which the speech of an orator would be handed down to all time and all mankind exactly as it sounded from the lips. All books worth reading verbatim would be read to the phonograph by elocutionary experts, and thenceforth read by the phonograph to the hearing, not reading, public, who would thus be saved the labor of reading, and perhaps the art itself would go out of fashion. It wasn't until the telephone had proven that a vibrating membrane could reproduce speech signals that anyone put two and two together and thought of reproducing sound from a phonautogram. The honor of first proposing to do this goes to the French poet Charles Cros, who, like Léon Scott, staked a claim to his idea by depositing it in a sealed packet with the Academy of Sciences. The envelope you see here was deposited in April 1877, and Cros first went public with his idea in October. But Thomas Edison was the first person to make this dream a reality. He came up with the same basic idea as Cros, but from an entirely different direction, based on efforts to automate messages for transmission by telephone. News of Edison's work first broke in November, the first demonstration outside the laboratory followed in December, and by 1878, the press seemed to have caught phonograph fever, speculating endlessly about what wonders the new invention would bring, for instance, in women's hats, as you see here, two novelties in bonnets, the telephone and the phonograph. Now, at long last, there was a talking machine, a machine that could speak far more intelligibly than Faber's, even though it was so much smaller and simpler. And what was more, it was also a phonograph, a machine that could capture all the nuances of speech and performance, not for reading, as had been assumed, but for listening to. Behold, the phonograph by which the sounds of the human voice may be preserved for ages. Note the phonograph kicking, the traditional pen and ink aside. After all, who would want to write or read anymore, when you could simply talk or listen, thanks to the phonograph? The Cincinnati Commercial raised the prospect that, quote, within the next 30 years, we shall become a nation of listeners instead of a nation of readers. And predictions of the demise of literacy were widespread. Here's the phonograph at home reading out a novel. Edison boasted that phonographic publications would be able to undercut the cheapest printed book. Even the poorest person could afford a whole library made up of sheets of tinfoil and could listen to it while at work, eyes and hands freed from the printed page. Think of the advances in education. Children could use phonographs to learn the alphabet, while adults could use them to learn to speak foreign languages with perfect pronunciation just by listening to recordings with no need for a live tutor. Most of the fanciful uses proposed for Faber's talking machine could now be done, and done better, by phonograph, ranging from the delivery of railway announcements, seen here as amplified by steam whistle, to the provision of speakers for lecture circuits, or mechanical preachers for churches. I quote, a convenience for clergymen. Here, John, take my phonograph to church and don't wake me for a couple of hours. Now, this would be no lifeless robot voice as with Faber's machine. Instead, the message would come out automatically and recognizably in a person's real voice, bottled according to one popular metaphor. Phonographic documents would be more reliable than written ones because handwritten documents could be forged, but who could forge a voice? One prediction was that bank checks of the future would rely on metal phonographic strips, since nobody could convincingly alter the amounts of money a person had spoken, and all the expression would be reproduced and preserved. A landlord, peeved at his tenant, could hassle him automatically with all the power of the living voice.
Smith, the money you pay for rum to treat your seedy friends with would pay the 3 weeks' board bill you owe me.
Even the voices of the dead could continue to speak, as we see in this cartoon. A voice from the grave. Maria, promise me that when I'm dead, you will never marry old Stingit, says the deceased via phonograph, putting a damper on his widow's courtship. And here was to be the concert of the future. Thinking of scenes like this one, critics worried that the new technology would destroy the livelihood of musicians by recording and then replacing even the best of them. So these are some of the possibilities that might have been on your mind in the summer of 1878 as you took your seat and prepared to witness the marvel of a speaking phonograph exhibition at first hand. And remembering how Faber's talking machine used to converse with members of the audience, you might not have been entirely surprised to hear something like this.
My name is Mr. Phonograph, and I'm not so very old. My father, he's called Edison, and I'm worth my weight in gold. The folks, they just yell into my mouth, and now I'm saying what's true. For just speak to me, I'll speak it back, and you'll see I can talk like you. My name is Mr. Phonograph, and I'm not so very old. My father, he's called Edison, and I'm worth my weight.